So it's my very great pleasure to introduce our speaker this evening, Gary Pakenham. So that stress at the beginning, isn't it?
Yes,
so
correct. Pakenham, yeah, yeah,
so, yeah. Who is a senior lecturer at Royal Holloway and the incoming director of the Finnish Institute in Athens. So, and he will be talking about his work on pattern detection in pattern detection in archaeological data. So I think, you know, a really sort of good emphasis on the quantitative use of quantitative methods in archaeological research, which is, I really think, at the core of a lot of what we do. So, Gary, please.
Thanks, Stuart. Many thanks for giving this possibility of introducing some of the research. But I think the last time I had a talk on this topic in London is already 5-6 years ago, and so that was quite a lot in the initial phases of research, and it's gone quite a bit further since then. Can statistically significant patterns be detected in late Bronze Age Aegean balance plates made of lead? How should we approach the question of what type of design system the 5th century BC Greek architects used for Doric temples? There's no shortage of modern interpretations, but is it possible to say where the one hypothesis is more probable than another? And I have to say that I started, my background is in architectural studies, and the Bronze Age led was there that I had an inkling that the same type of method I was using for analysis of the architecture could actually work quite well with the lead weights, and that's why I'm presenting those together. So first time ever, I'm actually sort of stretching from architecture all the way to back to classical architecture down to Bronze Age lead weights. Lead is far from an ideal material for balance weight. It's soft and it oxidizes quickly. The oxide is also very friable and easily breaks away, thus reducing the mass of the weight. Despite this, most Bronze Age Aegean balance weights were manufactured of lead. It was cheap, dense, and easy to shape. The second topic, so analysis of Doric building plans and facades showed that arithmetical proportions can, with reasonable precision, be fitted to architectural measurements. But there's far less consensus among scholars about the possibly used metrological units and whether the 5th century Doric design system can be classified as being based on a fixed-sized module. The modern architectural measurements can be quite far removed from any original design. The final execution of the building might be several steps away from the initial design. Substantial variation can be detected in the size of supposedly uniform dimensions. Many buildings are poorly preserved, and slightly differing sets of modern measurements of the same buildings are not infrequent. The task of the modern scholar is rather difficult, but I hope to outline today how it can be done, or at least one approach to the topic can be done, and on the road also point out some of the shortcomings of the traditional analysis methods. What is needed is a good knowledge of the archaeological data and an understanding of what the statistics can do. I do not think that the two can be separated. It took some 10 years to work out to start to see where the answers could perhaps be found on this research issue. So I've basically been doing it since early 90s. And then from that point on, so another 10 years to get to a point that I think I can do at least give much better answers to the questions than before. I will first outline the background of the questions and then go on giving at least some hints of where the solution may lie. In the context of Bronze Age Eastern Mediterranean as a whole, stone is the most common material for balance weight. So I took one good sealed deposit, so the Uluburun shipwreck, and the cargo dates the sinking of the shipwreck to the last quarter of the 14th century BC. And some 149 certain or possible balance weights were excavated in the wreck, and the well-preserved stone weights have been divided into 9 different sets. There were at least 4 sphendonoid, so the top part, I'll give an idea of what the sphendonoid balance weights look like. And at least then another 3 dome-shaped balance sets. So those are side profiles at the bottom. And I've recently argued that that's a 4 disc shape, that balance weight can also be recognized among the excavated objects. So W60 is one of the Aegean type discoid objects. Several disc-shaped balance weights have markings which can be interpreted as numbers. The table gives a summary of the range of the balance weights from so tiny fractions to large multiples with a mass of more than a kilogram. And you see the summary, so you could just go to Petruzzo's early 1990s work and then you will get a nice summary of the balance weights which actually can be analysed. That's what the markings most likely mean. And Petruzzo's analysis, so on the resultant units on the right-hand side of the slide, that gives a very strong indication that the measurement unit should be somewhere in the region of 60 grams. And there's been a long, long fight that where this is, it 60 or 65, and how to actually interpret the lead weights. But before going into a detailed analysis of the Bronze Age wave metrology, I first like to take a closer look at Doric architecture. It's a more complex problem, and I think it serves as a better introduction to the question. There's some evidence of both empirical and textual that ancient building dimensions could have been rounded to the nearest full feet or fractions of feet. So, for example, the 4th century temple of Athena Alea at Tegea, so that's one of the temples I worked mostly with in the 90s. That's the basic platform. It's actually not I did quite a complex analysis. It's one of the studies in the handout, so the 2005 studies on the temple. That's most likely the stylobate and the euthanteria, so stylobate just below the columns, and also then the euthanteria are possible to express in round number of feet, but not all the other ones of the main dimension. And it needs to be stressed that, as we will see later, traditional design studies taking the standard foot units too much for granted often fail to detect any real relationships. And Greek architectural inscriptions rarely employ fractions smaller than a quarter foot. For example, the building blocks of the still incomplete Erechtheion at Athens, they're inventoried in late 5th century and then it was completed towards the end of the 5th century. And most dimensions are expressed in terms of either full or half feet. So like in this, in translation, 4 blocks not placed, length 4 feet, width 2 feet, height 3 times half a foot. And if you're interested in looking at the studies related to the Erechtheion, there's the 2006-2007 publication in Talanta, which I've analysed in detail, the Erechtheion and the inscription and the foot units. Simple arithmetical proportions are one effective way of designing a well-balanced building and could also explain the changes from one building to the next. For example, the Roman architect Vitruvius was very fond of simple fractions, and from his references we know that the practice went back at least to the Greek 2nd century architect Hermogenes, and his Ionic buildings, but very likely Hermogenes was using much earlier design principles, but literary sources place this at least into the 2nd century BC. Architectural scholars agree that a modular design pattern can be quite easily detected in 4th century and Hellenistic Ionic architecture. The temples of Athena at Priene and of Artemis at Magnesia are typical examples. Both temple plans are strictly modular, and the axes of the surrounding colonnade and the cella walls match very closely. In the temple of Artemis on the right-hand side, the central bays at the front and the back are wider than others, so you see here just the central bay, but the cella design follows the wider spacing, so it's basically just widening the grid at one point and then keeping the grid entirely to the rest of the building. In most 5th century BC Doric architecture, the stylobate proportions seem to be secondary to the column spacing. And there was one sort of 5th century, but 4th century, they sometimes found a solution that they can actually keep both, that keep slightly bigger proportions and also the interactual distance between the columns on the short sides and the long sides the same. The remains of the old temple of Poseidon, so the red ones from roughly about 500 BC, are incorporated as part of the foundations of the later temple at the site. In the old temple of Poseidon, the front and the flank interactions, so the distance between the centers of the columns on the long side and the short side, are the same. And so the architect obviously fixed this distance. So the first thing that's looking at the plan, the architect is that decided that the X and the Y need to be the same. And that means that's then the overall proportions of the silobate are sacrificed. So it's not anymore 6 to 14 or another sort of hole, but okay, it's very close in this case, so 6 to 13.9. But you have cases where the proportions are very, very difficult to figure out from the dimensions. It has been suggested that monumental Greek buildings were designed using a measurement unit unique to each building. This is not an unlikely proposition as it initially sounds, and could explain why there is so little consensus what comes to 5th century Doric design. The length of this Jochbus, comes from the German scholar who first put it forward, would have been derived from the interaxial column spacing. One practical result of this suggestion is that it would be nonsensical to try to derive the standard lengths of Greek foot units from building dimensions. And this is quite a typical pattern what happens with Greek architecture studies, that scholars take the building dimensions and then come up with standard Greek foot units. And there's very little other evidence than the building dimensions. So on most of the Greek foot unit studies, they actually use the building dimensions for their argument of what the foot unit lengths in the Greek world were. And this has been a standard hobby of a number of scholars, and so they obviously are not too keen on the hypothesis of the Jochbus that's particular to each individual building. The previous discussion of the design of the various orders can be used to illustrate another potential problem. He describes in detail the proportional relationships between the various parts of the building. The illustration presents Coulton's very informative pictorial summary of the different strategies. There's a clear difference between Doric and Ionic orders. The Doric has a clear radial pattern, with most of the dimensions derived rather directly from the module, while the Ionic is much more linear. Vitruvius Doric can be classified as a clearly modular system. Establishing the relationship between the various parts of the building should be a rather simple task involving not much more than testing the different possibilities with a pocket calculator. Analyzing successive systems such as Vitruvius Ionic can be a much more difficult exercise. If the dimensions were rounded at each step, it's possible that the height of the sima, so at the very top on the right-hand side here, at the very roof of the building, there's no precise proportional relationship with the size of the module. The whole design can be much less transparent than the Vitruvius Doric. So it's actually funny that in reality, when looking at the buildings, especially going to the 4th century building, that the Ionic are much easier to decipher than the Doric buildings. So it's exactly the opposite relationship to what Vitruvius proposes in late 1st century BC. Taking building dimensions and expressing them in terms of possible Greek measurement units does not advance our understanding of Greek architectural design. And the reason is quite simple. Almost any metric dimension can be expressed quite well in terms of at least one of the proposed units. The unit selection and measurement ranges presented here are based on Wilson Jones's relatively recent HAA article, and it shows the situation around the 1 meter mark. So from 97.5 centimeters to 102.5 centimeters. The red zone indicates the only measurement range which cannot be given as feet and axles as defined in the study, and the pink range gives the short stretch not covered by the Attic or the Doric units. So, for example, if we have a triglyph width that's been measured as 98.0 centimeters, then that could be 3 Attic feet and 5 dactyls, or it could be 3 Doric feet, or it could be 2 Samian feet and 13 dactyls, or it could be 3 common feet and 3 dactyls. Stretching the size and a number of possibly used foot units renders most metrological analysis empty exercises. But again, I hope to show that an approach which does not start with the predefined notions of the sizes of foot units can actually avoid the dangers outlined here. The layout of a Doric building is rarely as transparent as an Ionic one. This is due to the relationship between the columns and the frieze. In the hypothetical wooden peristyle, there's no corner conflict, so at the top over here. There's no corner conflict since the triglyph width matches the architrave depth. So you see here that the triglyph is the same as the depth of the architrave, so it's possible to keep the frieze regular all along the building. In stone buildings, so the depth of the architrave is here A, and the depth of the architrave is greater than the triglyph width, so A is greater than T. So either the frieze elements have to be stretched, so like here you see that the corner metal B has been stretched to accommodate the difference. Or the distance between the two corner columns needs to be shortened. So that's the standard 5th century mainland solution, that's you actually bring the two columns in the corner closer to each other, and that way you make a more or less regular frieze. And if you look at do observations of classical Greek buildings, what most often you see is a compromise. So the architects most probably used a thumb rule for first placing the columns in which in most cases produced a more regular frieze. But almost some adjustments needed to be done at the frieze element. So you don't actually come across in 5th century Doric building that all of the frieze elements would be what the ideal should be. So if the architect first designed the frieze, then you'd easily end up with that you have uniform sizes for the metopes and the triglyphs. But there's always some kind of playing around. So they adjusted by 2 inches or sometimes even quite a bit more. And in Sicily, they actually much prefer the keeping the column distances the same, and then they play around with the frieze elements. So that's the solution that they use in Western Greek architecture. However, by the end of the 4th century, there were architects who were willing to test whether Ionic modularity could be introduced into Doric buildings. I have some time ago suggested that the Temple of Zeus at Stratos in Western Greece was indeed, so Western mainland Greece, not going all the way to Italy and Sicily, was indeed planned following modular principles. And that's another publication in the handout that's there. The Greeks tolerated quite substantial variations in the execution of their monumental buildings. This is not surprising since all the blocks were finally cut to size at the building sites and fitted to the stones next to it. Even in the Parthenon, the different parts of the building don't quite match up. For example, in the eastern facade, the axis of the second column from the north, so second column here, the red line over here, is 18 centimeters off the vertical joint of the architrave blocks. Trimming the length of the large corner architrave block would have resulted in further problems one step up at the frieze level. And if you go into the British Museum and have a look at the metal piece over there, you'll see that they had to chop off some of the tails of the centaurs So they started carving the metopes before they basically knew that they what exactly the size they needed at the freeze level. And when they come into the position that they need to place the metopes in place, they can't actually fit them there anymore. So they chop off the tails, they put in new tails, and they make the blocks a bit smaller. And that's quite common in Greek architecture, that it seems that there was no real overall design of the buildings from the day one. So you start with thumb rules, you start building, and when you get into problems higher up in the building, you solve them when you're there. And it's quite understandable that the architects or the masons who were responsible that they didn't want to cut first of all, you create problems at the higher level, but also that getting very large blocks of pentelic marble is not a simple thing. So when you have a block that actually goes and that it might be a bit too big, so 20 centimeters is something that they place on the building and then solve the problem when it arises. But it's quite natural that you take the biggest blocks you can find, you use them, and that means that you have a little bit of room to play with the next blocks that are coming from the quarries. There's wide agreement between scholars of Greek architecture that proportional systems relating the size of the building elements to each other were used by Greek architects, and that these proportional relationships can be detected by studying the actual dimensions of the building. Analysis such as the one Mertens gives here for the unfinished temple at Segesta, they seem rather convincing. But one question invariably rises: how precisely should the actual building dimensions fit the presented scheme? I have not come across too many studies where this basic question is satisfactorily solved. It naturally varies from building to building, depending on the ancient execution, current state of preservation, and the skill and tools of the modern scholar. However, I hope to give one possible solution to this question later on. So apologies for it's a bit difficult to read, but it's just for simple illustration here rather than looking at it in detail. Here's one particular modular reading of a temple facade, so it's the same one as in the previous slide. So on the unfinished temple at Segesta in Sicily. We have Wilson Jones's reading that he actually proposes that the temples were all designed using the first deciding the frieze and basically a module related to the size of the triglyph, and he comes up with a scheme that uses fractions to fit all the dimensions to his triglyph module, and then he comes up with the sort of how these dimensions are expressed as the Doric feet, and it's actually the third column it's at least I see it as problematic that he calls it adjusted dimension. So he simply reduces the discrepancies between the proposed system of the scheme and then the actual measured dimensions. And you get some very small discrepancies in the last column to the right by introducing the adjusted dimension column in this case. And then I think that's something that we don't need to do. So we could do something without looking at a sort of hypothetical scheme. And I think it needs to be stressed that I do not think that the traditional way of trying to detect Greek design patterns is satisfactory. The whole question is centered around measurements, and there's a whole branch of mathematics which is capable of dealing with fuzzy data sets and can help us find patterns behind the actual dimensions. I do not think that it can be overemphasized that deriving design units from building dimensions is a statistical problem, and studies which do not employ proper methodology are in serious danger of reaching false conclusions. One possible exploratory statistical method is cosine quantigram analysis. And it's quite curious that it hasn't been really introduced to standard statistical packages, but the method has been around since the 70s. But I initially did the programming myself on top of it, and now I've seen that there are other solutions that there are actually other people have been implementing the ways of doing the analysis. The analysis is based on the hypothesis that a building dimension X can be given in terms of an integral multiple, so M, times a design unit, so a Q from a quantum, and plus a small error component, epsilon. And if you look at it in practical terms, so if we have a dimension of 1.22 meters, then what that means that if you're testing it, how well it fits a design unit of 30 centimeters, then the closest match we can find is multiplying the design unit by 4, and then you end up with an error term of 2 centimeters. So a fairly good match and a fairly simple principle. And then it gets a bit more complicated, but not very much so. So we're basically looking at this epsilon, the error term, and then that's here. The core is here, the error divided by the quantum. And that can be quantified by taking the cosine of it. So we basically come up with a system that the better the dimension we're trying to study, the better it fits to the quantum, it will then return a value of a positive 1. So that's what happens with taking it with the cosine. So you end up with if you end up with a zero error, then you end up with exactly plus 1. And if you end up with a very large error term, you end up with return values of minus 1. And then you basically do is you sum up all of these values. So you just take, you go through every single measurement and you sum up them and you come up with a neat single value for how well the tested quantum fits all of the measurements. And what you end up is a neat curve. So this is what it tells you. If we take all the measurements from the temple of Segesta, we run it through the formula, and you end up with occasionally, so you have testing 30 centimeters, you end up with a positive value of 1, which is not very high. And occasionally you come across that you end up with peaks that are much higher than others. And those are where the quantum or the design unit fits the series of measurements the best. So you're always looking at where the highest points in the curve are. The main advantage here is one of the advantages that using analysis as such as this is that we do not have to make any initial assumptions about the size or the nature of the design unit that we are trying to detect. The graph gives every single possible design unit between 6 centimeters and 60 centimeters in this case. There's no sense in trying to test, you know, 6 centimeters might be too small. Testing too small dimensions, they would only give false high readings. In this case, there is one peak which is slightly higher, so around 11 centimeters, so this one. But do we know that whether this is statistically significant or not? One solution that I've suggested is looking at the computer simulations, basically going back to here. So we were looking at the values of the function score, all of that together, so this sum together, and looking at the curve that's being produced here. But we still need to be able to test the whether it's statistically significant or not. And for that, I've done Monte Carlo simulation random data sets. And they need to be created from non-quantile distributions. So here, one way of producing the non-quantile, so something that's basically has the same characteristics as the initial data set, but doesn't have the possible sort of set by the quantum. So we're trying to get random, basically random sets to set up a base score to see where it's actually statistically significant or not. And here are the individual measurements. So all of the ones that are suggested by Mark Wilson-Jones are here as red dots, and then taking a kernel density estimate, so basically just drawing a normal distribution around the point you get into a kernel density estimate for the whole measurement data set. And that is something then you can use to recreate artificial data sets that don't have the quantum at all. So, but they will still be producing same number of measurements so you have the shorter measurements, you have a bit more than the longer measurements. And it will give you a a randomly selected data sets that don't have the quantum structure behind them, and when they are analyzed in the same way as the original data to determine whether the peaks as high or higher than the original regularly rise from the distributions. And the computer simulations give us a baseline against which the analysis can be compared. So here, I've done sort of testing, it depends a bit on the data sets, but 1,000 computer simulations, 1,000 times of a random data set, it gives usually at least sort of 5% significance level quite well. And here we see that the random data sets produce a baseline of score of only of nearly 4. So that means that Segesta quite clearly is not anything that's based on a single quantum. So there's no single design unit behind the data set. That we should have then scores that go above the baseline of 4 in this case. And it could be there could be several reasons why we end up in a situation like this, that we simply just have chosen the wrong dimensions, so we're not actually looking at the right place. So you're, and that's one way of, I quite often, at least initially, try to start with looking at other people's data sets. Then I'm not sort of trying to select data that would actually create a pattern that I want to find. And it's very good as an exploratory tool of looking at other people's conclusions. I think in this case, the more likely explanation is that the design is not strictly modular, and therefore cannot be detected by the cosine quantogram analysis. But if we start looking at where we have these high peaks, I've named them here Q1, Q2, Q3, Q4, and so Q1, Q2, and Q3 are all proportionally linked to each other. So a very simple proportion. So 3 to 5 to 1 to then 1.5. So quite a neat, and this is something that if you have proportionally designed buildings, this is something you'd actually expect to find in the analysis. And Q4 is also that it's, if you look at the, so it's actually in the range of, it's a group of peaks, but that's it's in the range of what's been suggested for the Doric foot unit. And so it might be that there's a fair number of dimensions that are actually rounded to the Doric foot in the building. And I think we have to move on from single buildings then to groups of buildings. And what I've studied so far is looking at a group of 10 buildings, again, so looking at Wilson Jones's article and what he's, the same buildings he's analyzed, same dimensions he's chosen, and then try to look at proportional relationships. So it's obvious that based on even a single building, that's perhaps where it should be going. So looking at how the, not single quantum, not the design unit, but actually proportional relationships between the different parts of the building. I started from the sort of bottom up, so looking at the use material with actual width of the building. So looking, taking the column axes on the outside, taking single interaxial spacing of the colonnade, looking at column diameter and a stylobate width, and then going up to also the column height, the from the abacus width. Taking the triglyph method, so all of these, and then trying to compare them to each other. And the principle behind studying proportions is quite simple. First, it must be decided which proportion we first wish to study, and the example gives the lower column diameter expressed in terms of the triglyceride weight. The Hefex stain produces quite a good fit, even in terms of the whole design unit, so it's basically the lower column diameter is more or less twice the width of the triglyceride, and then we end up with a proportion that's nearly 2. For Segesta, the same proportion then ends up being so 2 1/4. Again, we see this pattern of simple proportions being related to each other. And then you just simply take the whole data set and so treat it in the same manner, leaving naturally the proportion, the triglyceride width divided by triglyceride width outside of the studied data sets. And let's start with looking at a borderline case. So this is 10 classical temples together as a group. So taking the that if the building was designed using the frieze, starting from there, we should be getting quite neat series of proportions and very high scores. And yes, it sort of touches the 5% significance level. So that means that there is a relationship between all the building dimensions you can gather from 10 different buildings, so from mainland Greece and South Italy, compared to the triglyceride width. But there is a far better scores to be gained. So looking at the column interaxial. So basically what we saw in the earlier part of the around 500, depicting the distance between the column on the short side and the long side. And that one gives up a score of nearly 6. And it leaves hardly any doubt that the sizes of the elements in the Doric facade are proportionally related to building dimensions in plan. More specifically, it's 1/20th of the interaxial distance which gives the best fit. However, this does not necessarily indicate that the Doric facade was strictly modular. So cosine quantigram analysis is quite a robust statistical method. So it's entirely possible that it actually picks up the design unit behind the successive methods, so such as the Vitruvius system for the Ionic order. Even though it's thinner, we simply come to the core of where the design system starts from and actually then detects that system, even though we don't have really a modular system for the facade. And I think this one, just as a reminder, so we're looking at, in this case, about 200 proportions for each one of the buildings, and there's a clear pattern that all of the top scores are related to the planned dimensions of the building. So looking at the interaxial distance of the columns, the whole style of bed width, the actual width of the columns, the actual width of the facade. So all of these dimensions seem to be producing much better scores than any of the other ones that when you go into details of higher up, so triglyph, upper column diameter, abacus width from the capital. So all of those don't really seem to be producing any kind of patterns that are fitting to the whole group of buildings. Okay, so I think next one we should go then and go back to a single building. Take another building. We have now analysed 10 buildings that are sort of standard buildings. And let's go to an unusual one, so the Parthenon. So that's it's very unusual from what comes to 5th century Doric architecture. It's one of the few cases where you have 8 columns on the front instead of 6, and they were obviously testing with different proportional relationships. And it's also one of the buildings that's been discussed for the past 150 years, that's what's the design of the Parthenon. Again, we come up with the same pattern, that no single quantum, no design unit can be detected. So it's a way off. So anything that we have of the scores over here are way off from being statistically significant. And what I've done here, again, to avoid picking out dimensions, what I took was Riemann's dimensions from 1935, and he gives a table of I was not even trying to update his list. So just taking his raw data from 1930s, his dimensions of the building, and then dumping that into the statistical program, seeing what comes out. It's quite interesting, the pattern. So nearly all peaks are related to the proportional system and the intercolumniation of the building. So Q3 here, you see that they're quite simple proportions. So most often related to factors of two. You come up with a digital system that's the proportions are related to each other. Sometimes one fifth. So occasionally then there's also elements of one third, and you basically come up with a system that they had most likely a fairly simple system of proportions, and that comes through. That it's as a whole, it's so complicated a system that you can't really detect it by looking at just the dimensions. But the statistical analysis actually picks out the various peaks and how they are related to each other. And the next thing I think I need to do is then go back to the dimensions and see that how that actually relates to what each dimension actually means in terms of the proportional scheme of the building. And one thing what's quite interesting that a lot of scholars have analysed the building in terms of 4/9, and that doesn't seem to be coming up at all in this analysis. It could be something to do with the sum of the schemes that's use of 1/3, and I'm certainly going to have a look at the individual measurements. So go back to the 101 measurements and see what comes out of the top. Okay. So and there's also a couple of the peaks. So Q2 that can't be is not. In relation to the sort of proportional scheme, it's again so somewhere in the what's the traditional length, close to the traditional length of Doric foot, Q2 and Q7 over here. And there's one mystery peak that I can't figure out at all, so at the very lower end, and I think it's below the detection limit. So that's when you go to the left hand side, it's fairly random, that's the pattern. So you're actually dividing the distances by small units, and what they produce is a random pattern. So I think that's what's happened. We shouldn't be testing, trying to find small quantum as Q1 is in this case. Okay, so let's go briefly. I'm going to actually take this relatively quickly and say that, okay, we started with the method looking at architecture and then a Bronze Age balance weights should be a fairly straightforward question to tackle. And I'll start with the publication of Petruzzo in the 90s. So he analyzed 45 well-preserved late Bronze Age weights from the island of Chios. So they actually are, it doesn't matter if you see it, but they're at the top of the table. So he's data from Chios. And they're all lead weights, so mostly discs, a few are cylinders, and there's also one truncated cone. And in order to study what kinds of patterns can be detected in a larger data set, the first set from Chios or Irini is supplemented by another 121 late Bronze Age weights from the Aegean. And the set is dominated by lead weights, so 86% of the studied material. And I've set the minimum mass of the studied object at 10 grams. So usually that's just when you're trying to find, again, it's the same kind of problem. If you're trying to find small quantum and you go from 10 grams to hundreds of grams, it just confuses the picture, so you better have a cutoff point somewhere. You can always later return to the small objects. So top here is gives a kernel density estimate. So this is also the same one that I use then for producing the random data sets. But it actually gives a good summary of how the... Oops, I seem to have lost the... there it is. So it also gives a good summary of the size of the weights analyzed. So they all seem to be concentrating at below 100 grams, and there are sort of all the way up to 1.5 kilos or all along. Then, so the red one shows the Iorini, so chaos weights, and as we see, so that there's the flood line is there, and nothing comes even close to, again, reaching statistical significant levels. And so we have, quite interesting is the pattern detected here, so from E2 to H2, and they are all in the region of half of the unit that we saw in the beginning. So in the region of 30 grams or a bit more. So there is some kind of a pattern over here, even from the lead weights, 45 lead weights from Iaiolini. The blue line, so looking at then more weights, so we add 125 weights to the ones from Iaiolini, and you see that that's a the interesting pattern at this point disappears entirely. So whatever we can see at Iaiolini, that there is a very funny peak of several peaks related to the GN units. So that disappears when we're looking at the whole picture. But you get several other peaks. So so A2 over here and C2. So A2 is 1/16 of the proposed Aegean unit, and C2 is 1/4 of the Aegean unit. And they give an estimate, so somewhere 62 or 63 grams for the mass of the unit. Even though the peaks themselves are not statistically significant, the binary relationship between the peaks and the Aegean unit makes it possible that detected peaks are related to a so-called true quantum. So here we can actually, I think we can still talk of true quantum, because you need to have some kind of system that is a multiple of the other one. So you have to have a unit. So I think here you can always almost take the quotation marks away from the true quantum. However, the peak D2 doesn't seem to be, it seems to be something entirely different, and it's too large to be a quarter of the traditional Aegean units. And it's intriguingly is that when they've been analysing the Eastern Mediterranean units, it's twice the traditional mass what's been given for a Mesopotamian measurement units. Okay, and I think the only step we can go further from this, but that's see what happens if we increase the temporal boundaries and the number of objects. So late Bronze Age, we have a handful of more that I haven't analysed, but not still, we're not going to get anywhere too much further than that. We have the 200 lead weights, and they don't seem to be producing some kind of patterns are there, but not first-hand statistically significant. But if you take all of Bronze Age the weights that Petruzzo lists in his PhD, so we come up to more than 300 objects. All of the Aegean stone weights, lead weights, and then I've also separated half of them, so just looking at only the stone weights. So lead is problematic, that it's too soft as material, so you can expect that you could perhaps find a better pattern with stone weights. So peak, what happens here, so that looking at the larger group, so the blue line, so about 300 objects, and the peak D3, so we have previously the Mesopotamian unit, that becomes clearly statistically significant. It's exactly the same spot, so that means that there is some kind of a correlation between the Aegean units, or the Aegean weights, and then the Mesopotamian ones or Eastern Mediterranean ones from the unit D3. And it's also quite interesting that the previously what we saw, the quarter of the Aegean unit, so that also climbs up to be statistically significant when we're only looking at the stone objects themselves. And at the same time, it shifts a bit to the left. So it's not exactly anymore there in 63 grams. It's actually sort of quarter of somewhere around 60 grams for the measurement units. I think that this is one way of just trying to find different groupings of the weights and look those But separately, try to play around with them. So if different kinds of patterns start emerging, and again, the more you have objects, the easier you can start detecting the patterns that are there. And I did as a comparison. So okay, we might go actually back to the first to the very briefly to the Ayalini weights, the red curve. It has been suggested, so Alberti, she's analysed the excavation context of the 45 lead weights in Ayalini, and she observes that there seems to be varying meteorological patterns depending on the area where the sets of the weights were discovered. And she has later then asserted that these patterns indicate that there were two separate units. So one unit around 60 grams and another unit around 65 grams in use in Ayalini. But I think that it's possible to propose a much simpler explanation for the cluster of the peaks over here. The multiple units occur only in connection with Ayalini and not lead or stone objects from stone weights from other sites. And it's either the use, use well. So when the lead sets are being used in context for a longer time, so they will actually lose some of that. They get hit, and when you handle them, they lose a bit of the surface material and so on. So it could be used well that you end up with a slightly lighter set of weight sets. And or that's actually the deposition context that gives this. The preservation of lead objects is in the ground depends on the varying acidity and basicity of the soil at different parts of the site. And it could be that this is actually the explains they oxidize friable oxide actually falls off. So it'd be also just post-depositional that the issue of I don't think there's any chance we can actually propose that there were multiple units at use in Ayalini. I think there are other much better explanations for that. And it's also the continuous spread of the detected peaks over the range of from 30 to 33 grams. So that's I think that supports that's something else than rather actually quantum also the detected measurement units. And this is the final slide. So that we have luckily a good set of lead balance weights. So coming from a historical context in Athens. And the good part there is that they also give information, so indications, either through texts or symbols, what should be the mass of the object itself. So you don't have to just analyze the preserved weights. So you also actually look at the what's being indicated on the weight itself. And we know also from historical sources that there are at least four times changes in the employed weight systems in Athens. And so we should be expecting that there's sort of variation in when you actually look at the empirical data of the weights themselves. And it should be possible, therefore, to compare the results of the statistical analysis with the information provided by the weight symbols and texts on the objects themselves, and the identification of a standard, so does not need to be solely on the base of the mass of the object. So I was looking at Mabel Lang's analysis of 50 objects that she analyzed that were discovered in the Agora, and then also adding in Bernike's data that we're looking at, we come up almost to 400 weights from archaic to Hellenistic Athens. And it's quite interesting that the Agora date, so the 50 weights, they produce a single peak that actually just climbs up to be statistically significant. And the red line, so the blue line is the upper R weights, and the red line is then the overall data. That produces six peaks, and they are all actually in relationship to each other, so proportionally related. So all of these can actually be expressed in terms of the other peaks. So they're clearly part of the same pattern. And the peaks from E to H, those are all higher than any peak produced in the random simulation. So I don't think there's any question that that's we're actually on the looking at what's being detected in the data. And if we look at the sort of calculated, basically it's then possible to calculate what the single unit in terms of all the weights are. So I've calculated this data. You can actually see that there's the tail end relates to the changes in the historical sources. You get heavier weights later parts in Athens, but they're not frequent. You don't often discover the heavier the weights, the heavy standard weights in archaeological record. And that means that that's basically you can only detect the main peak. All of the side information gets lost in the statistical analysis, and it's only the weight legends and the textual sources that actually then can say that yes, you have multiple standards in use. And without the textual evidence or the symbols, we would be entirely ignorant of the existence of the changes in the patterns. And furthermore, so even though the Agora peak was detected as statistically significant, so based on 150 weights, it falls actually outside the range you can calculate then from the whole mass. If looking at 400 weights, that means that actually, even though you come up with a statistically significant peak for the Agora weights, it actually the rest of the analysis is pointing towards that we're getting a false reading. So this is quite dangerous, that 50 lead weights is not enough. You need more, and so you need several hundred to get. So simply the variation is too big, and I don't really understand that how you can operate. So that's what I've come across. That okay, the peak is quite sharp, but still that you end up with lead weights that have the current mass at least is 15% less than the peak, and you also end up that's a same system, you have lead weights which are 15% overweight. So either their production methods weren't that perfect, or simply that lead is such a horrible material to be dealing with that it's very difficult to analyze. But if we don't have several hundred from the Bronze Age context, I think we have to stop at that point just hope that we get a cache of like Iaiarini from a good context, and then it might be actually possible to solve the late Bronze Age question. Okay, thank you.
Thank you. Okay, I'm sure there are questions. Certainly, I'll jump in that case. You sort of mentioned the correlation between the Greek Bronze Age weights and Mesopotamian weights, and then at the end you mentioned the importance of kind of textual sources. Has there been, because of course you have numerous patterns of interaction, particularly between the Aegean in this period and Egypt. I'm just wondering if there had been if there was any sort of comparanda with the kind of the Egyptian sort of documentation you get at Saqqara, places like that, the royal cubit and that sort of thing. So
There's actually a PhD by I think it's Edward Castle. If you look at the article, the chapter I wrote, there's reference to Castle's PhD. So it's unpublished PhD, but he goes into quite a lot of detail looking at the Egyptian comparanda, and then using that also looking at the Aegean ones. And then going also on the Near Eastern one. So I think that's by far the best one. But he comes across that he uses cosine pentagram analysis, but doesn't actually look at then the statistical significance. So that's basically the problem with all the all the analysis that I've been using, that they are actually taking patterns as significant, which are probably not. And so that's the best source. I will do, as part of the sort of ongoing project, I'll be looking at certainly Petrie's collection of the Egyptian weights, because that's by far the best and perhaps most consistent one. And again, so it runs into, you end up with a collection of several thousand. And that's going to be interesting to see what kind of patterns come out of it, of that one. So that's going to be within the next half a year, so I will be looking at that. But yeah, I agree, it's a very, very fascinating topic. And there are these world system people who are saying that you have to be able to convert from one system to the other one, so do by calculations and so on. But if you have two separate sets of weights, why not? You can then just use your own set to do the weighing and then take the other one. And that's how you might be one even easier way than calculating. Okay, you can do the calculations in some cases relatively easily, but some of the systems are so complicated that I see much quicker to do it. Simply weigh whatever you're trying to do the transaction in. Use your own set of weights, and then the other person uses their own. And I think that's one of the reasons, like with the Uluburun wreck, you come across that you end up with different sets of weights in the same context. So they obviously are that, even though most of the material seems to be from Near Eastern context, that there's a good collection of Mycenaean material, and so Bulak has argued that there are two Mycenaean persons on board when it sank. But he's been arguing that they're not merchants, so that's it, since he hasn't been, he downplays the few lead objects that are there. I think they're quite clear Aegean sets. And I think that's, there's been quite a lot of discussion of it, but it's been partially hindered by the fact that the analysis of the metrology, I don't think they've been all the time being done properly.
Right.
So you end up with discussions that touch each other, but they don't really always overlap. Lawrence Ramstorff has studied a lot of the earlier Bronze Age materials, and he hasn't been that interested in the measurement units as such, but he's come across sort of new groups of objects that can be actually classified as weights in early Bronze Age. And he comes across that there probably is quite multiple units in use also in the Aegean. So probably not just the two that come across in Petrus' data, but I think it's more likely that there's three different, at least sort of three different units that are being used.
Thank you. Thanks for a fascinating talk. You just touched on something I was about to ask you, but just to backtrack on that a little bit, I mean, lead's a very valuable material, so it's not that surprising there aren't too many. And surprising at all to find there's any dug up from the Andorian Athens. But you're going to have buyers and sellers weights. That's the first thing that popped into my mind when you're looking at the variation. As you say, the two parties each have their own sets of weights, because of course the seller's weight is going to be heavier than the buyer's weight. So you're going to go up with your own slightly skinned one. So unless you're going to have an enforced system of weights and measures, and such as we have in the EU, you get carted off. Or maybe the Scythian police drop down on the Agora and check your measurements every now and again on market day. But you're always going to have variations between the buyers and the sellers' weights. And leading on from that, do we have anything in the literary evidence regarding weights and measures, particularly in the Athenian system, that the people have been, for instance, prosecuted for having false weighted points?
I haven't been looking at the orators that is there anything there, but they certainly were metronomoi who were responsible for the control of the weights, so that there's an office, officers in the Agora who have their own room, and also that's we have official sets of measures. So there's quite a lot of official sets that are for volumes. So you end up with the system that actually is marked, but it says dimension, so public weights, so that they obviously were controlling the Agora in Athens. So that there's a good amount of archaeological material that points towards that direction.
Is that a water measure? So is it looking at the actual volume of the weight rather than the weight of the weight?
That's
because you've got the issue of then having non-lead fillers in it.
Yeah, that is possible, and we do have that in the Bronze Age, so that they have plugs, so that's they of different materials that are actually inserted. But it might be also control that's it's one way of not necessarily cheating, but it's then part of the manufacturing process that's having plugs of different material that it's easier to subtract a bit off, I think it's going to be. Always a problem unless you do the weighing yourself, and it seems to be so. Looking at the context from Thera, so that's a lot of the houses obviously had their own sets of weights. So most houses that have been studied seem to have at least some indication of they might be that they're all. Part of some kind of manufacturing process, but it might be that it's more widely used than we think.
I was actually going to ask a follow-up question on that sort of theme, which is, you know, you sort of have to ask the basic question, why do people need to weigh things?
Yeah.
Because they're engaging in some sort of economic activity and, you know, sort of moving from the middle to the late Bronze Age, you get the economy is moving to a more redistributive model where you have social elites collecting merchandise in and then redistributing. You know, that has to be regulated by a measurement system. So I was wondering, is there any other sort of work that's been done, for example, on the volumes of storage jars, which, you know, must have, you know, been facing the same sort of issue as the weights?
There are at least sort of beginnings of looking at the problems of the volumes, but there we have a problem that's much more difficult. How do you reconstruct when you don't have a fully preserved pot? So what's actually the initial volume of it? So there have been sort of calculations of trying to establish the capacity of the pots, but of the issue of looking at the context of the use of how you use work in the past sort of 10 years, it's very, very good on that. So she's looking at the context of the use and a couple of volumes and several articles on that issue. So I think it's moved a lot. So when Petrus started doing his stuff in the 70s, so looking at the lead weights. So he was one of the first ones of trying to get into a sort of proper scholarship, and he's also one of the first ones using it outside the initial Kendall's analysis, so using the cosine function rank analysis already in the 70s. So there is a fair amount of work over the past 30 years. It seems to be coming and going a bit in waves, and then in the past 10-15 years there's been lots of work on the weights and the metrology in general. I think it's not only the lengths and the weights, I think there should be sort of proper studies of also the other units of measurements.
Could I just make a comment about storage jars? I was at a conference last week in which Chamal Pulak was actually talking about the Canaanite jars from the Uluru wreck, and there they have a huge survival of jars of different sizes. So that work is about to be done, which is extremely interesting. And the other thing I would mention is the site of Mar Palae Castro on the west coast of Cyprus, where there are a good number of weights, and on both metrologies, on the Aegean system and the and the Near Eastern system. And this is a fairly short-lived site at the end of the Bronze Age. So clearly, whoever was operating there was looking both west and east in terms of the measurement system.
Can I take us to the temples? I was wondering if you could take us back to your quantum grounds and perhaps elucidate a little bit more exactly what one was supposed to make of the various peaks that you thought of as being significant ones, so the kind of highest ones you get.
Oh, yeah, so.
Because when one's normally looking at the kind of standard treatments of measurements and stuff like that, one will be thinking about them being particular bits of the temple and then being able to reconstruct, you know, which bits are being related to each other in terms of specific proportions, and then even going so far as some kind of claims about either regional proportional systems or, you know, Pythagorean number theory informing things. And it wasn't clear to me how one would connect up, you know, these kind of diagrams to thinking about what a temple design looks like and the kinds of cultural inferences one might be making about design beyond the fact that there might be some kind of statistically significant measurements somewhere in the temple.
Yeah, the one reason, let's take the table, so that might be it's a bit further down. So that's looking at it might be actually even easier to do it from a case study. So when you do looking at the like here. It simply tells you where you start looking for the first initial relationships. So that's when you take the 200 or so dimensions of the 10 temples that we're looking at. So there is a pattern that the column interactual distance. So basically, the what's the distance between the columns. Is the one dimension that all the rest is better related to. So that's the I think even that's a step forward. So that's currently where the discussion is going. So like taking Mark Wilson Jones's article, that he builds a very nice case of looking at freeze level and he's sort of trying to look module, and from there builds up a facade reading that basically relates all of the other dimensions to this design unit. And what I'm saying that you actually have to start from, or the statistical analysis, so start from bottom up. So start with the plan dimensions, and there you can start building up that it's going to be more likely that the elements that are further removed from the plan, if we get to the point of looking at, just take the Vitruvius design system. So, and again, so it's no real surprise that the plan dimensions produce a better fit for the whole mass of dimensions. So that's seems to be already that Vitruvius was thinking in those terms. So he actually derives the module from the overall width of the building. So he's already thinking that the plan level is where you start, so building from bottom up. And it's going to be often difficult to pinpoint how exactly one dimension is part of the overall pattern, but it might be possible. So I'll start first with the ones that are related to the actual width of the building. So see if there's anything in the dimensions further up on the building that actually maps to that one, and then go on to looking at the other dimensions that don't seem to be fitting the scheme. So it might be that they actually are the ones that are then rounded, so they don't really care about the proportional relationship as such. But it might be that they are rounding them to the closest half foot. That the proportional scheme gives some kind of indication where it should be but it's much easier then in practical terms to use a rounding number of a dimension for that initial purpose. But I'm just saying that we shouldn't be fixated on looking in these terms from the very beginning. So first do the statistical analysis, see that it, where that points towards. And I don't think I can yet give you a really good answer. That's you will need sort of looking more thoroughly through the individual. I've done it in terms of looking at the Erechtheion, and there you end up with fairly strong signals of the foot unit coming through. So 5th century Athenian Ionic, that they have, they probably are rounding quite a lot of the dimensions in the plan of the building to fit. It might be that simply that it's relatively close to a modular design, so it also produces nice round numbers of feet for but it doesn't really when I was comparing to all the dimensions, the pattern is not as neat when you're looking at the individual measurements as it when you read it through the statistics. And it seems that the statistical analysis picks up the general pattern, but then all of the individual measurements that don't contribute towards that pattern, they can be quite difficult to read. So
the little peaks in your kind of red diagrams.
Yeah.
What are they things one can label as saying exactly what they are? They're just so.
Yeah, like this one. Yeah, so this one is starting to look at the mass of the 10 different buildings and how all of those dimensions relate to the interaxial distance. So it's actually looking at the proportions instead of the actual measurements. So you scale before doing that. So you actually, what you're analyzing is these proportions. So not the individual dimensions themselves, but you're actually analyzing the proportions that are there. And then you come up with the wherever it's most consistent, that highlights the plan dimensions as the starting point of the patterns. And so like here, so triglyph width, that there are peaks, so there are loads of proportions where that's in the building or in the whole set of buildings that are either half of the triglyph width or one quarter of the triglyph, and you can see here a whole triglyph, so that there are loads of proportions that are related to the triglyph, but it's not nearly as close to as significant as you get with the interaxial itself. So by that point, when you get to the freeze level, the triglyph width, there's all kinds of roundings happening, and so the signal is there, but it's not as strong as you get from looking at the plan dimensions. So I think Coulton was spot on. So in the 70s, when he was looking at Vitruvius and then reading that it's sort of a successive system. So it gets so opaque that the whole that they do all these roundings and approximations, and then these designs are not executed perfectly. And you end up with a system that looks like it's just simply numbers, and you don't know where to start. And that's, I think, that's the has been one of the main problems with design analysis, that we haven't been able to agree where to look. And so what I've been trying to do with this is that at least we would have somewhere to start looking at, and then build up the schemes and hopefully come up with something that's relevant also to the ancient architects. There's a good start of the work of looking at statistics of Coulton already in the 70s, but he was actually quite a lot hindered by the computing power at the time. There's a lot of very, very good ideas how to look at the Greek architecture in his articles in the 1970s. And it's a real shame that the articles get quoted, but there's not a lot of people who read them. So it's the same problem that you get, that you get quotations to the articles, but I think they're even wrongly quoted, that Walton is not actually saying what the other sort of that are reading the summary of what they actually are proposing. I'm sorry, I can't give you a sort of full answer.
No, very much.
Yeah. And if you look at the Erechtheian publication, that gives you some kind of it's how difficult it is to actually then relate each individual measurement to the overall scheme, even when you get good readings. So that it simply is that and I think that this is actually one of the reasons why Greek architecture is so fascinating, that it's very difficult to reduce it to statistics. That they are wonderful buildings.
Have you looked at examples of temples where you have different periods of time over which they're built? For example, if you're thinking about Mark Wilson Jones' argument, it would be very difficult to see how he could make that argument about some of the temples in Sicily, which are kind of built over several generations, because one wouldn't expect the later architects even to know exactly what the original plans were.
Yeah, and not as such, but I think it's a good indication also that you it will be just one more factor of creating more opaqueness, so that it's not the translucent, so transparent what's the design that's there, and it's certainly is a factor with the buildings but again, if you think of the sort of continuous design of what happens with the building, so even if it goes over several generations, it's not that dangerous, so that they will then and if you look at other buildings like the Temple of Hera in Olympia, where there's they were replacing the columns one by one, the wooden columns that were built around the early 6th century, then still when Pausanias went to the site, there was still one column in the Opisthodomos standing of the wooden ones, the original ones. So 700 years later, they still had one wooden column of the building, and all of the other intervening columns are all different, all capitals are different. You wouldn't even recognize that they're from the same building, that they've been replaced one by one all over the centuries. Those kinds of things happen a lot with Greek architecture, and I think the one thing is that's the issue of the handicrafts, so that's actually products of craftsmen who are willing to fudge. So as long as the seams are perfect, then it doesn't matter if the sizes of the elements vary. So like we saw with the Parthenon, and if you go and look at the eastern facade of the Parthenon, you see it's clearly visible, even with just by looking at how the axes go astray. And I think it just makes the building more exciting rather than it being a flaw. It's much more alive as architecture.
This is a whole other question as to why these patterns might exist, not just if they exist. I mean, of course, the obvious. It would be like on the Parthenon, for example, the columns taper, or to make them look taller, if you're standing at the bottom, that sort of thing. And then I suppose that you would need the written sources for.
Yeah, so for certainly some parts, yes. And I think one reason for the thumb rules that it simply is a practical way of building. So it's one way of passing on the design of the building, and that's obviously that the Greek architects were already what they wanted to do. So already in the 6th century, they're writing treatises of the building. So it's probably actually one of the first forms of Greek prose. What happens is at the same time it's the philosophical prose and then the architectural prose. They actually originate both in the 6th century, in the same area as well. So that they are passing on. It might be sort of what to do with the engineering, how they build these sort of great temple on Samos and that. So, but they obviously are very proud of their designs, and so that's one way of doing it, is by through these proportional rules and thumb rules, and it's also one possibility that how the designs get passed on. So that if you only have a region where there's one temple is built in one generation, so it's unlikely that if they have a local architect, now there are, for a long time thought that so the temple of Zeus at Olympia was one of the only ones that built in that generation. It's a local architect, but now there's been a few other ones discovered in the same region, but it certainly is not something you could do as a career. If you have one building, now, how do you have a local person then who designs a building? It might be one solution that they also have the literary sources in indicating.
Okay, so anything else anyone wants to ask in the sort of formal setting or quasi-formal setting before we move to the totally informal setting? Possibly not. Well, just to kind of wrap up, just to say that from a couple of conversations I've had with Angeliki over the summer, I think quite a lot of these issues will probably come up in her talk next week as well. So, I hope to see you there. I'd just like to thank Gary very, very much again for that.